good news, and you know, hundreds came to faith, hundreds and hundreds came to faith. And one day this young fella came up to him and sort of said, oh, Mr. Spurgeon, oh, can you teach me to preach, you know, preach like you? And he says, Charles Spurgeon says, oh, you know, what's the problem? He says, when I preach, it doesn't seem to kind of have the same impact that you have, whatever. And so Charles Spurgeon said, oh, okay. He said, well, you don't really believe that every time you preach that people are going to come to faith, do you? He goes, well, no, of course not. And he says, well, that's the problem. And I do think there's a reality, this is not my talk this morning, but just bouncing off what you were saying, Richard, there's a complete reality in the Anglican Church. We've just lost confidence in the gospel. You know, we just lost confidence in it. And, anyway, last night I was talking about the church and the fact that we are in decline in the West. And I think if you don't count immigration, I think we acknowledge that around our country that basically we're in decline. And I made the point that I thought it was primarily for two reasons. Because basically I think God is still God and God is all powerful, so I can't put the blame at his door. So therefore, I'll put it at our door. And I think primarily it's because the church is out of alignment to God, and I talked about that last night and talked about flabby, compromised and adulterous, idolatry, not adulterous, probably you can add that one too if you want. And but then I said that also I thought the church was out of alignment to culture and society, and that's what I want to go on to and talk about this morning. I want to talk about how I think we're out of alignment to culture and society. And this really kind of, this talk really came out of about 3 years ago. I had a really profound experience, really, which was one of those experiences which wasn't comfortable, but it caused me to go on a journey. And a group of followers of Jesus asked me to come in and do some training for them. Now, I have to paint you a scene. These are about 20 adults who had relocated to a low decile community to share in what God was doing there. And they all self-supported went there. They all relocated their houses, their families. Nobody paid them. And they went in there. So highly committed Christians, you know, about 20 of them, highly, highly committed. And they were in this neighborhood, and they've been there for quite a few years, so very faithful, not just kind of parachuting in for a day and out. They are living in there for many, many years. And they asked me to come in because they were doing this youth program, et cetera, and they had a whole lot of community young people, 12-year-olds mainly, and they wanted me to come in. They said, you know, they wanted me to come in and help them because they wanted to increase the spiritual temperature of their community outreach, I suppose was the language they were using. And most of these group of adults were good evangelicals, and you know, they were completely faithful to the gospel, and you know, were hard out for Jesus. And so I went into the room, and there's 20 of them, and I said to them, okay, first activity, I want you to turn to the person next to you, and you have 2 minutes, and I want you to imagine that the person next to you is a 12-year-old, and I want you to share the good news with them. Go. And it was really interesting. It was really interesting. The room burst out laughing with a kind of awkward, ha 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 ha, you know, and then some of them got on to talking to each other. And after about 2 minutes, I put them out of their misery. And I said, so how many has honestly said something? And only half the room put their hand up. Half the room basically said nothing, and they were honest about it. They didn't really know what to say. And then I said, so those of you who actually did say something, what did you say? And I asked some people, and I said, well, so what did you say? And they said, oh, I talked about the difference God had made in my life and other people, you know. I said, well, so what did you say? And they said, oh, yeah, I talked about what my life was like before and after God and what God had done and all this. And I said, okay, so how many has mentioned Jesus' life, death, and resurrection? and nobody did. Really interesting, eh? Is that when it came to, though half of them had nothing to say, and the other half, what they could say was they could only testify to their own personal experience. They couldn't connect it to the big story any longer of Jesus. And I suddenly thought, this is really interesting, because these were all really good evangelicals, but for years now, they had lived in a missional context in New Zealand amongst the community, and what had happened over that time is the formulations that they knew from 20 years ago, they no longer made sense of in the same way, but they no longer knew what to say. Does that make sense? They were highly committed, so they completely believed in God's transforming work in their life. They were empowered by the Spirit. They were quite happy to pray for healing or whatever for people, but they no longer knew what to say. Because I think what had happened is the faith that had been proclaimed to them 20, 30 years ago no longer made sense in the missional context that they found themselves in New Zealand, because society and culture had changed. And I think that's where we find ourselves. So I think for vast parts of New Zealand, society has changed. And the narrative and the language we use actually just doesn't make sense to them. I'm not saying it's not true. I'm saying to the people we're talking to, it doesn't make sense. Got the difference? And so what I want to do is go on to explore a little bit, because this caused me to kind of have like an aha moment, like, wow, okay, so I need to really think about this, and I need to try to work out what we actually do proclaim, because this is a big problem. And I think often in our churches, what we're finding, our churches that are growing are primarily growing through transfer growth, which means we're just talking to each other in the language we talked about 20 years ago, but it's all right because they knew that language 20 years ago, and so they're just moving across. If you go to our churches, there's very few people actually new coming to faith. And those that are also in that kind of close cultural connection to the church who know the language of 20 or 30 years ago. They grew up in that kind of context. But the vast majority of New Zealand, and especially the younger generation, it's just not making sense to them. But again, it's not because God's not real. And it's not because we're not trying really, really hard. But I think it's like, you know, it's like if we've just gone into a different country. And we've just colonizing. And we haven't actually done the work recently to say, what do these people really think? What is their language? What is God speaking to them about? And we've assumed that what we heard 30 or 40 years ago, that society and culture is in the same place. But it's not. My view is it's significantly moved on. Does it make sense? So I'm just going to give you a few thoughts, a few explorations. And this is my journey trying to get my head around this missional context we find ourselves in. And, you know, and I think, you know, and there's probably multiple missional contexts we find ourselves in. One thing, just to get you started, and just to make sure I can, you know, you can stone me early on in the talk as opposed to later on the talk. Let's go for one of the heart of the thing. And Bishop Richard so well talked so strongly about sin. Actually, the younger generation don't even have that concept at all. To preach Jesus died for your sins doesn't make sense, because they don't feel like they're sinful. They don't feel like sin is a problem between them and God. So, you know, straight away, that language doesn't make sense. Now, I'm not saying they're not sinful. Got me? I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that language as a point of connection to say to them, you're a sinner and you need Jesus, they'll go, what do you mean? I'm not a sinner. I don't even understand what you mean by that. So why would I need Jesus? Now again, I'm not saying that sin's not real. What I'm saying is that conversation, hanging out with people under 50, it just doesn't make sense. They just don't use that language. And I don't even think they have a huge sense of they've done things wrong. Now, I do think we need to have that conversation somewhere with them down the track. But as a first point of conversation, I personally find it not a particularly useful first point of conversation. So let me give you some things that I talk about. And let me tell you how I get to talk about these. One of my great things about being a bishop is in our diocese we have 13 Anglican schools, and Anglican in name, probably very not really Christian at all, the people who go there. And so I give each school a day a year where I go into the school and I just put myself in front of classrooms and I'll say, I'll do Q&A. And they can just ask away and I just answer their questions. And it's really life-giving and really challenging spending, 7 hours of a day in front of teenagers who will just go for it, and we'll just talk about it. And so over the few years, I've just got to kind of work out what to say so that they actually, it works and it engages and they kind of hear it. And so that's kind of where I practice. If you don't get it right, you get eaten alive. And it's good. It's good. So here's a few thoughts, and this is just where I'm up to in the journey, and this is how I proclaim it. Because what we think we're trying to do, and if I had a diagram, I'd give you the diagram. What we're trying to do is this, and I think this is the challenge we have now, is we're trying to find the overlap between three circles. Okay? The first circle is we've got to proclaim what is biblical. Okay? That's the first circle. So it has to be biblical. The second circle, though, is it has to make sense to the people we proclaim it to. It has to actually itch where they're scratching, or scratch where they're itching, one of those ones. Okay, so it has to actually make sense of their cultural context. And the third circle it has to overlap with is that I myself have to have integrity to proclaim it. Especially this day and age, I can't sell somebody else's thing if I don't believe it myself, if I don't experience it. A high value of authenticity nowadays, you can't proclaim something that you yourself, at your core gut level, you don't experience. So you're trying to find the overlap between those three circles. And, the biblical story, we're trying to find the overlap, but the biblical story offers lots of different narratives and ways of explaining the atonement of Jesus and what Jesus did. It's not just one approach. The biblical story is a complex tapestry that gives us lots of stuff to find and to talk about. People's context, and then the third circle is, can I actually with integrity proclaim this? And so I'm trying to find that sweet spot between those three circles. And I think what we've realized is that when I went to that group, what I found is the group's problem was they no longer had a biblical story that overlapped with where they felt like people's needs were, because their biblical knowledge was probably pretty lean and they no longer had a biblical story, and they no longer could proclaim it with integrity what they had historically been told, because they knew it no longer made sense to the context they were in, and that was their challenge. So here's some thoughts, and I'll fly through these relatively quickly. First thing is this, is look, most people I meet, non-followers of Jesus, don't have much of a problem with the kingdom of God. When I hang out with people, if I sort of say, hands up, who would love to see climate change solved? Hands up. Hands up if you'd like to see climate change stuff. Thank you. Goodness sake, people. I'll take photos and send it back. They didn't put their hand up. Hands up if you'd like to see child poverty resolved. Hands up if you'd like to see every young person in New Zealand grow up and have a job which is meaningful and fulfilling. Hands up if you'd like to see every if you'd like to see our crime rate reduced and prisoners get meaningful reintegration so that actually our communities are restored and made safer. Hands up if you'd like to see every mental health consumer find a greater either healing or wholeness of life where they're integrated back into our communities meaningfully. Okay, I think most non-Christians agree with that stuff too. So people kind of want the Luke 4 picture. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me to preach good news to the poor, to bind up the brokenhearted, etc. They want that. They kind of want 90% of what we want, maybe 98% of what we want. The challenge is this, though, is everybody wants the kingdom. They all want the harmony. They all want the peace. They all want the right ordering of the way we relate to each other. They all want that. But what they want the kingdom without the king. And so whatever we proclaim, somewhere around the place, we have to do what Richard said, which is we have to say who's on the throne. We can't deny the reality that in order to have the kingdom, you must have a king. Okay, so whatever I say next and on from there, that is the starting point, is that in the end, Jesus is Lord. There is a king. And we can't have the kingdom without the king. So that's the first point. However, how do I engage in a conversation? These are the starting points. These are the points that I find resonate when I talk to people. It's really interesting. I come from a youth work background, still live with a whole lot of young adults and support them in their youth work, have a lot to do with young people. What I used to love about youth work is this, is that very quickly in youth work, a young person's issues you could pick them up pretty quickly. They wore them on their sleeves, you know. They just kind of, and most young people I worked with and hung out with, and even today, most of them, at the core of their issue was a issue of self-esteem, or the language I would use is shame. Difference between guilt and shame. Guilt is when you feel bad for what you've done. Okay, you haven't paid for your Affirm conference. That's guilt. Okay, and so you should feel guilt. Okay, shame is when you feel bad for who you are. That's shame. When you just don't feel good enough, you feel like everybody else is better than you. You feel like you're just not right. That's shame. And most young people in New Zealand that I relate to have a sense of shame. It's actually quite epidemic, I reckon. And that's where I really liked becoming a priest, because I thought, well, as I become a priest, I maybe won't do so much youth work, and I'll get to hang out with adults. And then when I hang out with adults, I no longer have to deal with this epidemic of shame. However, then I thought, I'll really look forward to becoming the bishop. Because then all I have to do is hang out with clergy. And then finally, I won't have to hang out with people who are under the epidemic of shame. Do you know what I've noticed? The only difference between a young person, an adult, and a clergy is all of them struggle with shame. The only difference is the further along that line you go, the better you got at hiding it. Does that make sense? And I think there's something deep at our time in life where we live in this epidemic of shame, where we just don't feel right. We don't feel good enough. There's a sense of dis-ease. And I think there's, if you do TED Talks, go for Brené Brown's TED Talk on vulnerability. Her TED Talk is 7th in the world rated because it resonates. She hits shame and it resonates. It just makes sense to people. And she wrote that great book, Daring Greatly, on shame. And so I think shame is our deep felt need of the Western world. And I think the gospel speaks into that situation. And if you think about it, the original Adam and Eve, when Adam and Eve stuffed up in the garden, God came looking for them. So God wasn't sort of like, hey, I can't have anything to do with you fellas, you stuffed up. God came looking for them, but what was their response? Shame. The initial response was they covered themselves and they hid themselves in shame. And it's interesting that crucifixion wasn't just designed to kill somebody. It was designed to be the most humiliating and shameful way of death, so that everybody else looking on, there would be this huge statement to the world that you had been not just killed, you had been annihilated in shame. And Jesus went through that. Jesus went through that shame and rose again. And so I think in this picture of shame, and when we talk about shame, and the answer to shame is so wonderful, because every day I get to meet with the King of the universe who says, hey, you're my beloved, on whom my favor rests. I think you're brilliant. I love you. And every day I get to relate to the King of the universe who reminds me of my value. And every day our message is this, that God so loved this shameful being that he came and died for me. What value do I have? I have the value of the God of the whole universe dying for me. And suddenly, I'm no longer trapped in this epidemic of shame, that there is good news. There is wonderful news that I don't have to be trapped in this, that God died for me. Second thing that I proclaim. The other day, a while back, I live next door to the Dean of our cathedral, Digby. And Digby and Jane, his wife, they go shopping for me. They think that my wardrobe's not that great. I want you to know I've got my best wardrobe on today. Actually, I was here last night and Joe from Wellington was here, and Joe sort of said to me, oh, you've put on your flash clothes. Anyway, so Digby and Jane go shopping for me because I don't think my wardrobe's very up to it. And they go shopping at the warehouse. That's how bad my wardrobe is. They think they can improve it by going to the warehouse. And they brought back this T-shirt a while back that had this. The T-shirt had all these Marvel superheroes like Captain America and all those kind of people on it. And it had the writing, it had, trust me, I'm a superhero. Now, I would really love to buy each of you one of those T-shirts. Not because any of us have superhero powers. You know, you're not invisible, Mr. Invisible, or you're not, you know, whatever, the Iron Man or Wonder Woman or whatever. Not because any of us have superpowers. But because what we know is superheroes have a purpose in life. And superheroes have a purpose to defeat every power that will seek to destroy this earth. And we're people of purpose. We're people who have been commissioned by God to spend our life making sure that any force on this earth that seeks its destruction, that seeks to dehumanize, to deface God's creation, that we stand against those forces. So we have been given a commission to be the people of restoration, to restore people to themselves, to restore people to God, to restore people to each other, to restore people to creation. We have been given that commission. So we're people of purpose. So while there is still child poverty in Auckland, there is no excuse for not getting out of bed. And while there is still climate change ravaging our earth, there is no excuse for not getting out of bed. And while there are still young people or adults who are caught in an epidemic of shame, there is no excuse to not introducing them to the one who can save them. And what I find is I relate to so many non-Christians who the narrative goes, I go to school to get an education, to go to university, get a better education, so then I can get married and I can have a house with a white picket fence, it's a bit more expensive in Auckland, 2.5 kids, a cat and a dog, and then I can save for superannuation, then I can draw down my superannuation, then I can die. And people are saying, surely there is more to life than this. Surely I was made for more than that. Surely I was made somehow to contribute to this world. And we get to invite them into that wonderful cosmic revolution where we join with Jesus to see this world transformed. And look, there is more to just getting one more plasma TV. And people want to join that revolution. They want to know their life has a purpose. And that's where Jesus came. And it's interesting, when Jesus came, he preached repentance. And then he said, hey, you fellas who are fishermen, why don't you come and fish for the big ones? He called them according to purpose. He called them out. And they left everything for the purpose of fishing for the big ones. And when I start talking to young people or young adults, and actually start inviting them into the godly revolution, then actually they light up, because actually they want to be part of that, because they actually know their lives are meaningless. Because there is only so many plasma TVs or OEs you can go on. And actually people are wanting something meaningful. And they love it when they come across a Christian whose life is so passionate and full. I mean, I met Mark Beale. I never met Mark Beale before. I met him today for the first time. I bet you I can introduce him to just about any non-Christian, and they would have found his life absolutely contagious. Because it's full of stories and adventures of wrestling for things that really matter. And that's our call. And we get to share that call, and we get to invite people into that great, great story. And here's the good news of being a New Zealander. The great news is this, is once you're 65, the government pays you to be a full-time superhero. What a great country! It just gets better. Third thing that I proclaim. Many years ago, I was in Melbourne, and I happened to go to the oldest Baptist church in Melbourne. It's in Collins Street in Melbourne City. And Collins Street, they have this whole sort of community program and all that. But they took me out to the main road. Collins Street is a very, very flash road in Melbourne. They took me out, and they took me to these shops. And these were all designer shops. And like, they took me to one shop, and they said, you know, you in this shop, you can buy a tie for like $500. I thought, man, it's an amazing tie. You must be able to text on it or something at the same time. And then they took me to this other store, and you could buy a designer handbag for like $5,000. You know, designer handbag. I think it doubled as a toaster. And it was amazing, you know. And they said, these are amazing. And then they took me out back, and out back. At that time, they had a real heroin problem in Melbourne, and out back, there was this alleyway that didn't even connect to the main road where heroin addicts would shoot up. And they had a whole needle exchange program and all that. And they said this, and it stuck with me. They said, out back here, you can buy a hit of heroin for $50. And then they said this. They said, who's the addict? The one who spends $50 on heroin, or the one who spends $500 on a tie? The only difference is one is socially acceptable addiction and one isn't. Both are killing us. Really interesting, eh? And when I look at my own life, I can kind of relate to that. I kind of feel like I'm addicted to, when we were talking about this last night, I kind of feel like I'm addicted to consumerism. And I kind of, you know, I hear myself preach, and primarily I'm preaching to myself, and I'm thinking, yeah, I just want to make my life count, but I want to watch Downton Abbey.
you know, I just want to get out there and tell people about Jesus, but after I've had one more latte. And see, I know what I'm called to be, but I just can't change. Sound familiar? And we're trapped. And everybody's trapped. And here's the good news. The good news is this, is that Jesus died. And when you die, that's it. The book is closed. It's all over. Death is the finality. Except for in Jesus' case. In Jesus' case, he rose again. Which means that our past does not need to determine our future. Because there is always an alternative. Because when Jesus rose again, a power was released on this earth that meant our past does not need to determine our future. That means where we were trapped, where we thought there was no option, where I'm caught in my addiction, there is always a power that sometimes breaks in and transforms my life. And whether that is physical illness, whether that's mental health, whether it's addiction, whether it's just slothfulness, whether it's broken relationship, where we cannot transform our own lives even though we so deeply want to. It's a 12-step thing. We acknowledge there's a power beyond ourselves that breaks in, and that resurrection power suddenly makes all things possible. And I can be transformed even though I cannot transform myself. And my relationships can be transformed even though I cannot transform them. And that is good news. Because so many people are trapped and there is no power as far as they are concerned. But our belief is in the resurrection Jesus, there is a power that has come into this earth that sometimes breaks into our neighborhoods and into our lives that offers an alternative that nobody should miss out on. And so I proclaim the power of God. I back that God turns up. I back that God can make a difference. I back that miracles happen, and I'll proclaim that. Because otherwise, we're just trapped. We're all trapped in our own ways. And I've got to believe in that resurrection power, and I experience that resurrection power, and I'll proclaim that resurrection power. And I find that makes sense to people, and that resonates with people, because people know they're trapped. And people know there are things in their life that they cannot change, but they so desperately want them changed. And that's when the power of God falls. So that's just giving you a few sort of signposts of kind of what I find when I talk to non-churchgoers, what kind of resonates, what kind of language I use, how I kind of have the conversation, which I think is still consistent with biblical truth. But does resonate with where they're at, and I with integrity can proclaim it. And again, this is just the start of the conversation, you know. And again, it is always about, in the end, to be in the kingdom, one acknowledges the king. But I do think we have to do the work now to realize that our culture and society has moved on. And that we need to re-engage as if we went to a completely different country with a different language to work out what does the gospel mean in this context? Because the gospel is always incarnated. The word became flesh and dwelt amongst us. And it's still doing that today. Shall I pray? Loving God, I thank you that you do make a difference. Lord, all of us, our hearts well up with gratitude. Lord, may we be a people empowered out of gratitude and out of worship to be your people of purpose. Lord, thank you for today, and thank you for the joy of being together with fellow believers. Bless us, we pray. Amen.
As before, folks, just let's spend a minute or so in just in silence. Just let what's come at you go a bit deeper.